do for Trina, because she'd always been much more than a coach to me. I saw Trina every day throughout high school. Like most teenagers, I'd gone through my share of angst and despair back then. I was finally old enough to understand what it meant to be abandoned as a baby, and I took out my anger about it on everyone around me. I was angry on the volleyball court. I was angry with my father. I was angry at my boyfriend for wanting sex, and even angrier when I gave it to him. For 2 years, I was a really unhappy kid, and the only person who kept me from going off the rails was Trina. She never gave up on me. She was still my closest friend, despite the 15-year age difference. I told her everything. She was literally the only other person in the world who knew the truth about me and Keith Whalen. Even my father didn't know, because he probably would have had to fire me if he did. Trina was tall, blonde, and gorgeous, and Anna was already growing up the same way. Trina's husband Carl was a handsome man, but the girl standing in front of me was a miniature replica of her mother. She was also stubborn and fearless, and I like to think she got some of that from hanging out with me. "Talk to me, Anna. Does your mom know where you are?"
"I have my phone. She can call me if she wants to know where I am."
"What about your dad?"
"He's on the road."
That was no surprise. Carl Helvick had a technology job and traveled a lot. Trina was still a coach and math teacher at the high school. The two of them didn't always have as much time for Anna as they wanted, so I filled in whenever I could. "How did you get here?"
"Bike."
"Well, what are you doing here anyway? Why were you hiding?"
"I was just hanging out. First, I was spying on Mr. Whalen. Then you came and I figured I'd spy on you too."
"People don't like it when you spy on them."
"It's just a game. It's no big deal."
There was a sullenness about her that was unusual for Anna. She'd always been a smart, sweet, mischievous kid, but she'd been standoffish with me for months. I was trying not to take it personally. Trina called it an early case of teenageritis, and maybe she was right. Anna had always been a few years ahead of other kids in most things. "Well, let's call your mother and get you home."
"She's not there."
"Where is she?"
"She's over at Jeremiah's house."
I closed my eyes in sadness, because suddenly it made sense to me. Of course Anna had heard what happened. Of course she was upset and scared. Jeremiah was her best friend. "You know he's missing?"
"Yeah, Mom said."
"Well, we have people all over town looking for him, Anna. We'll find him."
"Uh-huh."
Anna was only 10, but she seemed to know I was spouting empty promises. My father had done the same thing with the Sloanes. I guess we can't help ourselves from telling people what they want to hear. The two of us walked together in silence, and I put my arm around her shoulder. She was so scrawny at that age, nothing but bones. I saw an ornate stone bench near the fringe of a cemetery grove, and I guided her there, and we both sat down with the peaceful headstones arrayed in front of us. The trees hummed with birds and bugs. Sunshine streamed across the grass, but the bench where we sat was in the shadows, and I could feel the cold, damp stone through my pants. I hunted in my pocket where I kept a few sour balls for when I wanted a quick candy fix. I handed one to Anna, and she unwrapped it and put it in her mouth. I kept my arm around her, and I was pleased that she didn't pull away. At least for a little while, things felt normal between us. "Is that why you're here? Were you looking for Jeremiah?" Anna shivered a little. The sour ball made a little bump in her cheek.
"Yeah, he and I would hang out here sometimes."
"Did you find him?"
"No."
"Can you think of other places that he might have gone? Do you and he have any secret hideouts?"
"No."
"Are you sure? I remember Rose and I used to bike over to the drive-in before they tore it down, and we'd hang out behind the big screen. You guys don't have a favorite spot like that?" The girl balanced her chin on her fist.
"Nope."
"How are things at home? Does Jeremiah have any problems with his brother? Or his parents?"
"I don't think so."
What about problems with other people? Does he have any trouble with bullies? Are there kids who give him a hard time?
No. Everybody knows Adrian is on the football team, so they don't mess with Jeremiah.
I tried to sound casual with my next question. What about adults? Anna's brow crinkled.
What do you mean?
Well, has anyone been bothering him? Or making him uncomfortable? I know you and he are really close, Anna. Jeremiah probably tells you things he wouldn't tell anybody else. Even his parents. Know what I mean? And if there's something like that, I need to know about it, even if he told you to keep it a secret. Anna sat silently for a long time, and I could see on her pretty face that she was struggling with what to say. Finally, she spoke softly while staring at her feet.
We're not.
Not what? I asked.
We're not close. We're not friends anymore.
You and Jeremiah? Since when?
I don't know. A while.
Do your parents know?
I didn't tell them about it.
Why not?
Mom's got her own problems. She and Dad have been crying a lot. They don't think I know, but I know. I figured they didn't need me bothering them with my stuff.
When I heard this, I had two more things worrying me. Something was wrong in Trina's life, and she hadn't told me about it. And Anna had ended her friendship with Jeremiah without telling her mother. The apple didn't fall far from the tree in that family. I loved Trina, but people sometimes saw her as cold because she shared so little of herself. So what happened between you and Jeremiah? Why aren't you friends anymore?
Nothing happened.
Come on, Anna. You two have been best buddies since kindergarten. Something must have happened.
I just don't want to be friends with him. Does he have to be my friend?
No, he doesn't. But he's missing, and here you are looking for him. That makes me think you still like him.
Well, I don't.
I watched tears begin to slip down her cheeks. Her lips pushed together and her eyes were red.
I just want to go home now. Can you take me home, Shelby?
Sure, of course. I'll take you home. I got up from the bench, but then I knelt in the grass in front of her and brushed the tears away from her cheeks. Hey, Anna, you know you can tell me anything, right?
Yeah, I know.
Well, this is really important. Do you have any idea at all what might have happened to Jeremiah? I saw a look of terror spread across this little girl's face. Honestly, I'd never seen anyone look so scared. She cried harder and threw her arms around my neck and hugged me as if I were the only one who could save her from whatever evil thing was out there. Then she whispered in my ear, barely getting the words out.
I think the Ursulina got him.
Chapter 7. The Ursulina. It's a story as old as the town. I'm sure you know about Bigfoot and the Yeti and Sasquatch, those shaggy 8-foot monsters that walk upright through the forest. Our creature is like that, but with a twist. The legend of the Ursulina says that it can also take a human form. A pioneer family in the old, old days found that out when they rescued a starving fur trader and let him spend the night in their cabin. They awoke to the horror of a giant brown beast with 9-inch claws and curved fangs who proceeded to feast on every one of them. So you can understand why we're still a little nervous about strangers around here. Dad told me about the Ursulina when I was only 5 years old. I loved stories like that. The scarier, the better. Tourists love it, too. In the fall, we hold an annual festival called Ursulina Days. The town sells Ursulina t-shirts and mugs and magnets. People dress up in Ursulina costumes, and true believers come from around the world to search our woods for the monster. We even offer a cash prize of $100,000 to the first person who brings in an Ursulina, alive or dead. So far, no one has collected the money. 9 months before Jeremiah disappeared, Ursulina days fell over my 25th birthday weekend on Halloween. Monica recruited me to be part of the events. In addition to her job as the Sheriff's Department secretary, Monica was volunteer board chair for the Friends of the Library. She was planning a Halloween event for kids on that Saturday, and Monica always gets what she wants. She may be quirky and grandmotherly, but if you get in her way, she'll give you a little giggle and then mow you down. I've mentioned that I sing, right? I play guitar and I write songs, too. I don't claim to be very good, but I've done it since I was a little girl. Every now and then, I'll let my arm get twisted to perform at story time for the local kids. So Monica asked me to write an Ursulina song for the Halloween event. She already had an artist doing scary decorations and a writer who'd written a children's story about the Ursulina that he was going to read aloud to the kids. She wanted me to do the music, and of course, I couldn't say no to her. I didn't find out until after I'd agreed that the writer who would be working with me was Keith Whalen. It didn't bother me at the time. Yes, I'd had a major crush on Keith when he was a teacher and I was a student, but that was years ago. Of course, I'd be lying if I said I didn't still find him attractive. Keith owned a rambler on 50 or so acres of hunting land at the end of a dead-end road off the main highway. Most of the land was undeveloped, but there were a few trails that had been there for decades, and a creepy little jewel of a lake hidden away in a wooded valley. Trees grew right out of the water, and their branches drooped like Spanish moss. With not much sunlight breaking through the treetops, it looked like a pond out of a grim fairy tale where scary things might lurk below the surface. We called it Black Lake. The Stryker girls used to swim there now and then during the summers because it wasn't far from Trina's house. I went to Keith's place around Labor Day to talk about the Halloween show. His wife, Colleen, was there when I arrived. I knew her pretty well because she worked at Ellen's Mini Mart. She was always meek and quiet, with a cute face and mousy brown hair cut into bangs, the kind of woman who looked as if she would melt in a spring shower. I could tell immediately that things weren't good between her and Keith. It was nothing they said, but I recognized the faces of two people who were going through the motions of marriage and life. I'm sorry to say that my instinct was to blame her for making him unhappy. I still saw Keith as this complicated, interesting, romantic figure from my school days. He was my Heathcliff, and being with him gave me the same goosebumps I'd felt as a teenager. He took me to a barn on their property that he'd converted into a writer's cottage. It was on the other side of a hill a quarter mile from the main house and painted apple red. You could see Keith's personality in the place, with its hardwood floors, 1920s-era posters of Paris and London, jazz playing from hidden speakers, and a loft where I could tell he often slept rather than in bed with his wife. He had bookshelves filled with dozens of classic novels, everything from Cannery Row to The Moonstone. He kept a little shrine, too, of his military days, just mementos hung on a bulletin board near his desk. Photographs of friends he'd lost. His dog tags, a silver and blue St. Benedict medal on a chain, his purple heart. I wanted to ask him about those days, but I could tell that some subjects were off limits. While I sat in an old leather recliner in the barn, he acted out his story of the Ursulina. It was full of horrible deaths and blood dripping from people's faces, and I knew it would scare the snot out of the kids, which is the whole point of Halloween. I told him he should get it published, and he flipped his brown hair and looked at me as if I were crazy. But I knew he was secretly pleased. After we met, I wrote a song I could play between sections of the story, with a chorus that would have kids singing with me after they heard it for the first time. It went like this. Ursulina, Ursulina, look at those teeth and claws. Ursulina, Ursulina, look at those big brown paws. Ursulina, Ursulina, is he a scary beast? Yep. Ursulina, Ursulina, he's gonna eat you up. Okay, I was never going to give Sarah Bareilles any competition when it came to songwriting, but I figured the kids would love it. I wrote it in a week, and then Keith and I met in the writer's cottage again so I could play it for him. He loved the song, too. We rehearsed the whole performance many times, him doing the story, me doing the song, over the course of the next several weeks. We rehearsed way more than we needed to for a half-hour children's program. And we talked. We had long talks about things that mattered. He talked about teaching and reading and living without a leg and being married to a high school sweetheart who sent one man off to war and got a very different man back. I talked, too. I talked about my father, about Trina, about Anna. I talked about my belief in signs and omens, and about the challenges of growing up as a mystery girl with no past. I talked about my crush on him in high school. We laughed about that, but I was no fool. Telling him the truth about my feelings carried us across a dangerous line. The Halloween show was a big hit. Monica was thrilled. We had nearly 200 kids and parents gathered in the town park outside the courthouse, and they oohed and awed and screamed at all the right scary parts. Afterward, everybody was singing my Ursulina song. It was as close as I was ever likely to get to being a celebrity, and I was flying high. So was Keith. We hung around together as afternoon became evening and the festival wound down. We were tired, but exhilarated. Everyone was coming up to us and telling us what a great show it was. We drank it all in. As night fell, we went back to his place to continue the celebration. Colleen had already gone home and was asleep in the house. Keith said she slept a lot because that's what depressed people do. He and I went to the old barn and we put on music and we uncorked a bottle of Macallan that he'd been saving for a special occasion. The more we drank, the more he opened up. He grabbed novels from his bookshelves and read some of his favorite passages to me. He caressed his St. Benedict medal and talked in a hushed voice about losing his leg. He told me about his troubles with his wife. You know where this is going. I knew where it was going too, but that didn't stop me. I'm sorry. You may not be able to forgive me for what I did, and that's okay because all these years later I haven't forgiven myself. I was drunk, it was my birthday, and I let myself indulge a high school fantasy with a married man. God, I was stupid. A mistake like that was bound to have consequences. But never in my life did I imagine the consequences would include Colleen Whalen dead outside their house with a bullet in her brain. Chapter 8. After we left the cemetery, Adam and I dropped Anna back at her house, and then we headed to the Nowhere Cafe. We found my father drinking weak coffee and reassuring the worried neighbors crowded around him that we were doing everything we could to find Jeremiah. The Nowhere is where people in everywhere gather. It's more than a local diner dishing up pancakes and venison stew. It's our meeting hall, our water cooler, our ground zero for news and gossip. Black and white photos of earlier generations of everywhere residents watch us from the walls, and someday, photos of us will take their places. We meet in the red cushioned booths and along the lunch counter to talk about weather, sports, politics, religion, cooking, vacations, holidays, and the latest rumors about who was Zooming who. Half the town was there that evening. I knew all of the faces, but I could see something in them that I hadn't seen very often before. Fear. They were afraid because Jeremiah was still missing. The innocent explanations for what might have happened to him were fading away, and if it could happen to the Sloan boy, then it could happen to any of their children, too. I hung in the back of the diner near the glass door. Adam went off to flirt with the counter waitress, Belinda Breeze, as he usually did. Belinda was another striker girl from my high school volleyball team. Her nickname in school was Easy Breezy, and I don't suppose I need to explain why. While Adam put the moves on Breezy, I watched my father take questions from the crowd. I didn't like what I saw. His brown sheriff's uniform was crisply starched and neat as a pin. He'd changed clothes after searching through the dirt and brambles of the National Forest. His mustache was trimmed, and he'd tamed his thicket of snow-white hair with a brush. One thing Dad never did was allow the people of the county to see him at anything less than his best. He stood ramrod straight, emphasizing his height, and as the townspeople grilled him, he remained almost supernaturally calm. And yet he wasn't. I knew him. I could see the way his fingers were clutched around his thermos so tightly that his knuckles turned pink with exertion. He didn't look at people as he talked to them. His soft blue eyes were unfocused, a sign that his mind was spinning to the point of overheating. The muscles in his tanned face were tight. Like everyone else, my father was beginning to realize that he'd misjudged this situation. This was not just about a boy who'd wandered away. In the time we'd spent digging through the woods and searching the town, precious hours had been lost. Nobody paid attention to me. This was the kind of situation that reminded me that I was still just a young deputy, and a woman, too. The people who wanted answers talked to Dad or Adam, as if my opinion didn't count for anything. Even my father was guilty of that sometimes. I'd called to let him know that I thought Jeremiah's brother might be hiding things from us, but Dad wasn't ready to bother the family with more questions, not simply based on my hunch. I felt as if he were patting his little girl on the head.
Coffee shell?
Belinda Breeze appeared at my side with a Nowhere Cafe mug and a white plastic pitcher of coffee. The coffee was terrible, but I drank it anyway, the way I always did. Dad and I came to the Nowhere for breakfast 6 days a week at 6 in the morning, and we had dinner there on most days, too. Without the Nowhere and the occasional kindness of strangers, I'm pretty sure my father and I would have starved, because neither one of us could fry an egg without setting off the smoke alarms. I sipped the coffee, which was scalding hot. The voices around us were loud, and Breezy and I spoke to each other under our breath.
Terrible thing, huh? She murmured.
That was the word we all used. Terrible. It was a numb word, the kind of thing you say when reality is too hard to stare in the face.
Yeah, I replied.
Hard to believe someone took him, she went on. Not around here. But it's looking like that, isn't it? Wow.
I didn't say anything or make any guesses. I just listened to my father handing out hope to the people in the diner. I wanted to be an optimist like him, but we were running out of optimists in everywhere. Hey, have you talked to Trina lately? I asked Breezy.
Yeah, she was in for the fish fry on Friday with Carl and Anna.
Did she look okay to you?
As far as I could tell. Why?
Oh, it's something Anna said. It made me wonder if anything was wrong.
Well, you'd know better than me.
That was true. The others on the team hadn't stayed close to Trina after high school the way I had. We'd all drifted apart. 3 of the girls left town to go to college and never came back. Rose still resented being booted from the squad in favor of Violet Roca, and Violet had never been close to any of us. And then there was me and Breezy. She was the wildest of the Striker girls. We were good friends, but we were as different as a headbanger and a country star. She was much taller than me, which helped in our school days because she could unleash a vicious spike from the attack zone. My own specialty was a booming overhand serve. She was skinny and always wore long-sleeved shirts, even on the hottest summer days. Breezy had dabbled with drugs since I'd known her, and I suspected she had track marks on her arms that she didn't want anyone to see. Her hair was long, straight, and black, with shiny purple streaks, and when she was working, she usually had it pulled back into a ponytail. She had a plain face, and her teenage acne had trailed her into adulthood. She was the only one of our group who'd gotten married after high school, but she'd divorced a couple of years later when her husband skipped town for the North Dakota fracking fields after cleaning out their bank accounts. I knew he was bad news because he'd been my boyfriend before he was hers. And yes, I warned her, but girls don't always listen to other girls about that sort of thing. Since the divorce, she'd lived alone in a mobile home in Wichtree, but the word among the local men was that Easy Breezy didn't often sleep alone. The Gruders live over in your area, don't they? I asked her. Near which tree? Breezy rolled her eyes at the mention of their name.
Oh, yeah. They sure do.
They're back in town, I said. Did you know that?
I didn't. It must be a recent thing because they've been gone for a few weeks. They can get pretty loud over there and the noise blows my way.
Do you see them a lot when they're in town? Breezy gave me a strange look.
What's that supposed to mean, Shell?
It's just a question.
Well, they're at the Witch's Brew a lot, and so am I. No law against that, right?
I knew this was one of those times when people saw the uniform and not me. Even close friends never forget that you're a cop. Breezy had a history with drugs, and there I was asking about two of the region's suspected drug dealers. That was bound to make her nervous. I leaned close to her ear and whispered, Off the record, Breezy. I just want to know who the Gruders hang out with.
Why?
Because Jeremiah disappeared right after they came back to town. Maybe that's a coincidence, maybe not. She rejected the idea with a firm shake of her head.
You're way off base, Shell. Vince and Will wouldn't touch a kid. They may be dirtbags, but I don't see them doing that.
I shrugged. They sell drugs. It's a violent business.
Yeah, but you mess with a kid and the whole town gets involved. You think they want that kind of attention? No way.
Have you ever seen them with Adrian Sloan?
Jeremiah's brother? No, he's too young to be in the bar. What is he, 16?
Yeah, but the Gruders sell their crap at the high school, right? Could Adrian be involved? Breezy glanced at the Nowhere's long lunch counter, as if she needed an escape from our conversation.
I don't know, Shell. You're talking to the wrong person.
Would you tell me if you did?
Probably not. But in this case, I really don't know. I haven't heard Adrian's name from Will or Vince, but that doesn't mean anything. Okay? Now I have to go.
Breezy refilled my mug of coffee and waded back into the crowd. Her tease-me smile returned to her face. She put a hand on the shoulder of every man she passed and gave it a squeeze. They looked back at her like she was strawberry shortcake swimming in whipped cream. I was alone again. Adam wolfed down a burger at the counter. I hadn't eaten anything myself, but I wasn't hungry, so I pushed through the diner door and brought my coffee out to the main street. When I climbed into the cruiser, I opened the window. The evening had cooled down fast, and the smoke of someone's fire pit was in the air. It was dusk and would be dark soon, and wherever Jeremiah was, I didn't like to think of him spending the night away from his family. Not long after, the door of the cafe opened, letting out a burble of noise. My father had broken free from the Inquisition. He stood in the doorway, straight as an arrow, not letting on that anything was bothering him. He saw me in the cruiser and crooked a finger at me, and I scrambled out of the car to join him. The two of us headed across the street to the library. Dad used his key to let us inside, and we took the stairway down to the basement. The lights were on. Monica was still on the phones, calling seemingly everyone in town one by one. Her eyes looked up at us hopefully, but it only took a glance for her to realize there was no news. Dad beckoned me into his office, and I followed him. He sat behind his desk, laying both hands flat on the impeccably neat surface.
Always keep a clean desk, he'd say. Your desk should be as perfectly organized as your mind.
I think that staying organized was his way of keeping the wolf in his brain at bay. And we both knew the wolf was in there, stalking him. Dementia had claimed both of his parents. I stayed standing. We were silent for at least 2 minutes, and finally I had to say something. Dad, there was a 99% chance that Jeremiah would be home safely by now. You made the right call. My father nodded. I wasn't telling him something he didn't already know.
Unfortunately, Shelby, it's looking more and more like we're dealing with the 1% this time.
So what do we do next? He inhaled long and slow.
I'm heading back to the forest. We're still searching the area where the bicycle was found. These people will search all night if they have to. I'm proud of them. A terrible thing like this brings out the best in everyone.
I thought that was a generous sentiment, but also a little naive. People who are scared and upset usually take it out on someone, and that someone was likely to be my father. If we didn't find Jeremiah, he'd be the one they blamed. What do you want me and Adam to do? I asked. Dad reached into his inbox and drew out a single sheet of paper. He put on reading glasses and examined it as he tapped a finger on his desk.
Mrs. Norris called earlier to complain that she had a peeping Tom outside her window last night. She thought it was someone staying at Rose's motel. Normally I'd be laughing about another complaint from Mrs. N, but I'm not laughing anymore. The motel is just down the highway from where the Sloanes live. You better go check it out, Shelby.
Chapter 9. I stood on the county highway at the base of the steep driveway leading to the Rest in Peace Motel. From where I was, I could see the timber frame of Ellen and Dennis Sloan's house not far down the road. The sky was almost dark, and lights burned in every window. Cars and trucks were parked up and down the shoulder, and I knew friends were providing support to the family. I was happy that the Sloanes weren't dealing with this alone. Adam returned to our cruiser from a modest yellow cottage on the opposite side of the highway, where Mrs. Norris had lived since FDR was elected. We'd flipped a coin to decide who got to talk to her this time.
Mrs. N can't give us many details about her mystery stalker, he reported. She calls him Snuffle Man. Said his heavy breathing sounded like some kind of obscene phone call.
And this was last night?
Early this morning, around 5 o'clock or so before daylight. She was sleeping, but Snuffle Man woke her up, he was so loud. He was right outside the open window.
And is she sure it was a person? Sounds like it could be a deer snorting to me.
Yeah, Mrs. N says she screamed and grabbed her shotgun and went running to the window. You don't mess with a double-barreled 95-year-old who sleeps in the raw. She made sure to tell me that, by the way. Like I'll ever get that image out of my head. Anyway, she spooked whoever it was and he took off. She thinks he headed across the highway to the motel.
But she couldn't give a description of him?
No, too dark to see.
I peered up the asphalt driveway at the Rest in Peace Motel, or the Peaceful Rest, if you want to be fussy about its real name. Rose had inherited the place 2 years earlier when her parents died in a car accident. This was where she'd grown up, but I knew Rose had never wanted to be in the motel business like her parents. She liked to be on the go, and running the Rest in Peace kept her inside the office nearly every single day, which she hated. She was fixing it up and already had plans to sell it as soon as she could find a willing buyer. Rose wasn't married, and she was an only child. It's funny, when we were kids, I was a little jealous of her because she knew who her parents were. And then just like that, her mom and dad were gone. You'd think that kind of tragedy might have brought two old friends closer together again, but it really didn't. I offered to stay with her for a while after the accident, but she was pretty firm in saying no. I knew that Rose and I were never going to hunt for the Ursulina together the way we did as kids, but I still missed the closeness we had in those days. The motel was an L-shaped one-story building with 12 rooms and a dense stand of pines towering behind its walls. The doors were all freshly painted red and blooming flower boxes decorated the windows. It was the high season, and every door had a car parked in front of it. The highway advertisement featured two painted signs dangling from hooks below the motel's name. One said, "No pets," and the other said, "No vacancy."
"Full house," Adam commented.
"Yeah, let's go see if Rose remembers any snuffly breathers." We climbed the driveway to the bungalow in the woods that doubled as the motel office and Rose's residence. We opened the swinging screen door and went inside. The television behind the motel counter was blaring a home fix-up show, but no one was in the office. I saw real estate books on the desk. Rose was going after her realtor's license, and another laminated sign reminding guests about the no-pet policy. A
Around here, pets were prone to wandering into the woods and getting eaten. I rang the counter bell.
Hey, Rose, you around? It's Shelby.
The back door of the small house was cracked open, letting in a few flies that buzzed around us. I heard a muffled reply, and not long after, Rose appeared in the doorway, carrying half a dozen clay flower pots planted with daisies and African violets. She wore a camouflage tank top and jean shorts. Rose had always carried a couple more pounds than she liked, and her exposed stomach had the tiniest roll. Her skin was moist with sweat and dirty with paint and potting soil. Her reddish-brown hair was tucked under a beret.
Hey, Shelby,
she said.
Hey, Adam. Have you been here long?
Just got here, I replied.
Oh, good. Sorry I'm such a mess. I was out in the garden and I've been touching up paint on the doors half the day.
She dropped into the office chair and swatted away a fly with one of her motel brochures.
What's up? You guys find Jeremiah yet?
I shook my head. No.
Damn, that's so awful. He's such a great kid. I can't believe this. I just saw him yesterday.
Where was this? I said.
Right here at the motel. Jeremiah and Adrian both help me out sometimes during the summer.
Doing what?
Oh, Adrian moves furniture and other heavy stuff. Jeremiah helps me unload boxes. Soap, shampoo bottles, new towels, that kind of thing. Ellen likes to make sure the kids have plenty of summer chores, and there's never a shortage of things to do around here. Plus, Jeremiah's a little chatterbox, and I like that. He hangs out around the office with me.
Adam and I exchanged a glance. Does he meet a lot of your guests? I asked.
Some, sure.
And you said he was over here yesterday?
For a couple of hours in the morning.
Did he seem okay?
Oh yeah, he was fine.
Did anything unusual happen?
Unusual? No, just the same old, same old. Guests check in, guests check out, guests always need something. It's go, go, go all day long.
Do you remember Jeremiah talking with any of your guests yesterday? I asked.
I suppose he did, but I don't remember anyone specifically. People assume he's my kid, so they talk to him.
What was he doing while he was here?
Not much. I was too busy to put him to work, so he was batting around a shuttlecock outside for a while, until he lost it in the trees. Then he was working on a jigsaw puzzle in the corner.
Did he mention having problems with anybody?
Problems? You mean like with one of my guests? No, he didn't say anything like that.
Adam leaned across the counter.
Mrs. N says she had a peeping Tom outside her window early this morning. She thinks it was someone from the motel. Did she talk to you about that?
Rose rolled her eyes.
Oh yeah, of course she did. Every week it's something different with her. Complaining is what keeps Mrs. N alive.
Do you have any idea who this man was? I asked.
Not a clue.
I frowned and looked for a way to narrow down the suspect pool. She said he breathed really loud. Does that remind you of anybody staying here? Like a guest with allergies or something like that?
A loud breather? Seriously, you think I pay attention to that? The only problem I have is with people who are too loud at other things. Moms don't like it when the walls start shaking right next to their kids' heads.
What about men staying here on their own? Adam asked. Do you have anybody in a room by themselves? No wife or girlfriend tagging along?
I don't get it. Why are you guys so on about this? Jeremiah's missing, and you're worried about somebody peeping Mrs. N?
Rose cocked her head, trying to figure us out. Then a flush of horror spread across her face.
Oh, man. You don't think... one of my people?
My father asked us to cover all the bases, I explained. The thing is, if Jeremiah was hanging out here yesterday, maybe he met somebody. Rose swore. She took off her beret, wiped her forehead, and put it back on.
This sucks. I can't believe it.
Single men, Rose, Adam repeated. Anybody around here fit the bill?
Yeah, one guy.
Who is he?
I don't know. Nondescript, 30s, I think. Tall and skinny, buzz cut. He said his name was Bob Evans, like the restaurant. He paid cash for 3 nights up front, and he said he didn't want maid service.
That didn't raise red flags with you? I asked.
This is the rest in peace, Shelby. Around here, anything less than an active smell of decaying flesh doesn't worry me much.
Adam peered through the office window at the motel parking lot.
Is his car here? What does he drive?
A big gray Cadillac, I think.
Rose stood up and eyed the lineup of vehicles.
Yeah, the car's here. He's in room 106.
Adam didn't wait for me or discuss what we should do next. He banged through the screen door and took long, determined cop steps down the row of motel rooms. If there was a chance to be a hero, Adam was always right there. By the time I caught up with him, he was thumping his fist on the door of room 106. I went over to the gray Cadillac and squinted through the windows to see if I could spot anything inside. I did. The floors were thick with dirt and pine needles. Bob Evans had been in the woods. I also saw a large water canteen and a plastic bag tipped over on the back seat, spilling out a head of romaine lettuce and a small container of dried fruit chips. I recognized the logo on the bag. It came from Ellen Sloan's mini mart. I spun back to the motel room door. No one had answered.
He's in there, Adam told me. He's trying to ignore us, but I hear somebody moving around.
This could be our guy, Adam. Be careful. The boy could be inside.
Mr. Evans!
Adam shouted, banging louder on the door.
Police!
The motel room door opened 2 inches. A chain lock dangled across the space. I saw one nervous brown eye and a round face that dripped sweat. I also noticed a noxious smell busting out of the shut-up space.
What do you want? I want you to open the door, Mr. Evans, Adam told him. Why? What for? I haven't done anything. Then you won't mind if we take a look inside. Well, I do mind. I paid for the room. It's mine. You have no right to come in here.
He was right. We didn't. But in the midst of the standoff between them, I heard the thump of something inside the motel room, like the sound that someone would make who was trapped behind a locked door. Adam, he's got somebody in there. Adam heard the noise, too. As Mr. Evans shouted in protest, Adam slammed a shoulder against the motel room door and ripped the chain lock away from the frame. He piled through the doorway and tackled Mr. Evans to the ground. I leaped over the two of them like a steeplechase runner and landed in the middle of the worn, stained gray carpet. The only other door in the room was the bathroom door, which was closed. I heard the same heavy thud from the other side that I'd heard before.
Jeremiah! Jeremiah, is that you? It's Shelby Lake. Everything's okay.
I ran to the bathroom door and yanked it open. The instant I did, something erupted from inside, collided with my legs, and knocked me flat on my back. A snuffling, grunting noise filled my ears, and something huge and black began licking my face with a slobbering tongue. I shoved the thing away in horror and scrambled to my feet. Adam had a knee shoved into the back of Bob Evans and already had cuffs around the man's wrists.
Let him go!
I screamed. Adam hadn't caught up to what was going on.
What? Why?
Let him go! It's a pig! It's a pig!
I said it several times, and I may have added an adjective in front of pig that began with the letter F. The victim who'd been trapped inside the motel bathroom was a miniature pig, all black, probably at least 100 pounds, looking like a beer-bellied drinker at the local bar. The animal snorted its way over to Bob Evans, who was still trapped under Adam, and shoved its flat nose into the man's face.
Snuffle man, Adam exploded. This is what Mrs. N heard? The guy was chasing after his pig?
Looks that way. Adam flipped the man over and grabbed his collar.
I don't believe this. Why were you hiding it, buddy? You could have gotten yourself killed. The motel doesn't allow pets.
Bob Evans gasped from the floor.
The penalty's like $100 if you bring one in the room.
Adam shook his head in disgust and freed the man. The two of us were breathing heavily as the shot of adrenaline drained from our systems. When I glanced at Adam's belt, I saw that he'd gone so far as to unsnap the holster clip on his gun. We were all lucky. This could have gone south very fast. A pig. A pet pig. Not a child. I got out my phone to call my father and give him an update. The rest in peace was a dead end. We were no closer to finding Jeremiah. Chapter 10. After we left the motel, Adam and I drove the short distance down the highway to the Sloan house. Trina Helvick answered the door, and I could see a crowd of people behind her. It looked to me as if half the town was waiting for news with Ellen and Dennis. Adam and I needed to search Jeremiah's bedroom for clues, but I asked him to start without me. I wanted to talk to Trina first. She grabbed a sweater and followed me down the steps. We made our way along the fringe of an elaborate garden, where the flowers had shut themselves up against the cool night. The house lights threw our shadows across the grass. "How is Ellen doing?" I asked Trina. "Oh, she's in rough shape, as you'd expect. Ellen isn't the kind of person who can just sit there and do nothing. She likes to be in control of the world, and this is something she can't control." Trina always had good insights into what made people tick. That was what made her a successful coach. Control was how Ellen Sloan lived her life, with everything in its proper place. The garden at her house was like that, manicured in neat, colorful rows and free of weeds, with decorative fencing to keep out the rabbits. Her mini-mart was the same way, with every box of cereal or can of soup in perfect alignment with the one next to it. "Have you discovered anything at all about where Jeremiah might be?" Trina asked. "No, nothing yet." "That's so sad. That poor boy. I hope he's okay." "I know," I said. "Me too." Trina's face was stoic like a good Scandinavian's, but she was also a parent, with a daughter the same age as Jeremiah. I knew what Trina was thinking, that it could just as easily have been her child who'd disappeared. "Did you get my message?" I cut into her thoughts. "I found Anna hanging out in the cemetery this afternoon." "I did. Thank you for bringing her home, Shelby. Sometimes that girl is so headstrong," she added with a smile. "She reminds me of a certain high school volleyball player I used to coach." "A little bit," I agreed. "Did Anna say what she was doing there?"
"She was looking for Jeremiah. She's very upset about him."
"Aren't we all?"
The two of us kept walking through the Sloan's large, sloping backyard. The forest loomed at the end of the grass. If you hiked into those woods, eventually you would find yourself on Keith Whalen's land a mile away. The trails led past Black Lake, where the Stryker girls used to swim on Saturday afternoons. Trina would join us there sometimes, bonding with her players. It was during those lazy days, laughing together and telling stories, that I began to see her as a friend even more than a coach. Trina was 6 inches taller than me, statuesque and athletic, like a blonde model out of a Dale of Norway ad. She had a natural beauty that could make you self-conscious about your own flaws. Pale blue eyes, a sharp little nose, a face so symmetrical that each side looked like a mirror of the other. At 40 years old, she'd given almost nothing back to time, except for the faint lines that bent around her lips when she smiled. However, to me, she'd been at her most beautiful 5 years earlier, when she was completely bald and hugging her daughter as Anna cried into her shoulder in a hospital bed. I was crying too. So was her husband, Carl. The one who should have been crying was Trina, but instead, she held all of us together with an inner strength that I envied. She had every reason in the world to be bitter, but I never saw 1 ounce of anger or self-pity from her throughout the entire experience. "Anna told me that she and Jeremiah aren't friends anymore," I said. "Did you know about that?"
"Yes, it was pretty obvious. They haven't spent time together in months."
"Did you ask her why?"
"I did, a couple of times, but she wouldn't open up to me about it. I didn't want to push her." I figured she would talk about it when she was ready.
Well, if you can get her to tell you anything more, that would be helpful.
Trina cocked her head in surprise.
Why?
Just in case it's related to something going on in Jeremiah's life that led to his disappearance. At this point, we have to consider everything.
I suppose so. That's an unpleasant thought.
We stood in silence for a while. Where the trees began, I saw a young doe feeding on the leaves, its body barely kept upright by spindly legs. Looking at my best friend, I debated whether to ask her what was wrong. If she was keeping a secret from me, she had her reasons, and like Anna, she would talk about it when she was ready. Except Trina rarely opened up to me. She was happy to let me lean on her, but she resisted being vulnerable herself. For a while, I'd assumed it was because she still saw me as a teenage girl, and that she was more open with her other friends. Then I realized that I was wrong. Trina had acquaintances, co-workers, and neighbors, but in many ways, I was her only real friend.
"Anna thinks something is going on with you," I murmured.
Trina was staring at the doe.
"She said that?"
"Yes. She said the two of you have been crying."
"Carl,"
said Trina.
"Not me. I don't cry."
It always puzzled me that she was so proud of that.
"So what's going on?"
I asked.
"Now isn't the time, Shelby. You have other things to think about."
That was classic Trina. She was always pretending that she was protecting me when she was really protecting herself. It was a defense mechanism, a way to keep emotions at arm's length. I could have let the subject drop, but I'd learned long ago that I needed to keep knocking on the door until she answered.
"Is it you and Carl? Are the two of you having problems?"
"Oh, no. Carl is wonderful."
"Then what?"
Trina swayed slightly on her feet. She would do that beside the volleyball court, too, when she'd seen us making a mistake and was gathering her words for how to tell us. She never spoke off the cuff. She thought about everything so that she wouldn't have to regret it later. I was still struggling to learn that lesson myself.
"It's back,"
she said. That was all she told me, but she didn't need to say anything more. No other words could have frozen my soul more than those. It gets cold around here in the winters, but never as cold as that moment on July 17th.
"Trina, I..."
That was all I managed before my throat closed up. I had so many things to say, but I didn't say any of them. I took two steps to close the distance between us and wrapped my arms around her. I held on for a long time. She reacted stiffly, as if embarrassed by our closeness. Physical displays of affection made Trina uncomfortable, but I didn't care. When I found my voice, I said,
"What do you need? How can I help?"
"There's nothing you can do right now, Shelby, but thank you."
"I'm here, day or night."
"I know that."
"Anytime you want to talk, we can talk," I told her, "or not talk. If you want to sit there and say nothing, that's fine too."
Trina put a hand on my shoulder, as if she wanted to comfort me. Then she pointed at the back porch of the Sloan house.
"You're sweet, but we'll have to do this later."
"What? Why?"
"Ellen's here."
I turned around and was jolted back to my other reality. Ellen stood on the house's redwood deck with a cigarette in her hand. I hadn't even realized that she smoked. In the porch light, her face was all bone and shadow like a skeleton's. She stared at the sky as if she needed God to give her answers. 18 months ago, she'd lost her mother, and then 2 weeks ago, her father. And now her youngest son was missing. It would test anyone's faith. She saw the two of us on her lawn. She saw me on her lawn. I knew this wouldn't be good, and it wasn't. She crushed her cigarette into a flower pot, then stormed down the steps and stalked toward me. With every step, she fell to pieces. By the time she was in my face, tears flooded down her cheeks. Her skin was beet red with fury, and her whole body quivered. She screamed at me in the darkness from 6 inches away.
"How dare you even show your face here?"
Where's my son? Where's my son? Your father promised me he would find him. Why isn't Jeremiah back here with his family? I told you. I told you, and none of you listened. I told you I wanted roadblocks and helicopters. And all Tom Ginn could do was stand there and tell me everything was going to be all right. It's not all right. Jeremiah is gone. He could be anywhere.
Ellen's arm reared back like the cocking of a gun. She was going to slap me, and I tensed, waiting for it. Then she stopped herself at the last moment. Her open hand sank back to her waist and her eyes squeezed shut. Her knees buckled beneath her. She slid down to the wet grass and buried her face in her palms. Trina knelt and put an arm around her shoulders. Ellen leaned against her. They were two mothers, both staring into their own versions of hell. Ellen, I swear to you, we are doing everything we can to find Jeremiah. Ellen's cries died out slowly, and her eyes opened. With Trina's help, she stood up, and I could see that her pant legs were soaked with dew from the grass. Her fever had broken. She'd cried herself out. She wiped her nose and cheeks with her hands, and she took a loud breath. She was calm again, in control, in charge. I had to admire her for that.
I talked to Violet, she told me. I conveyed my concerns to her.
What concerns?
Simply put, Tom's not competent to handle this investigation. I know he's your father, Shelby, but we're talking about my son's life. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. I want him off the case. I want this handled by professionals. I should have insisted on that from the beginning. As it is, we've lost the most important time we had to find Jeremiah.
I tried to take my emotions out of it and not be defensive. I was a deputy, not a daughter. Ellen, bringing in strangers isn't the way to go. Nobody knows Middle County and the people around here better than my father.
Maybe so, but he doesn't have the experience or resources for a case like this. This is bigger than Middle County. Plus, let's not kid ourselves, Shelby.
Kid ourselves about what? Ellen stopped, as if she'd gone too far.
Nothing.
No, go ahead. What are you saying? She looked right at me. So did Trina. The fact is, I knew what Ellen was going to say before she said it.
Tom's no longer up to the job. Mentally, I mean. I know you may not be ready to face it, but that's the truth. He's going the way of his parents.
You don't know that.
Take off the blinders, Shelby. I'm sorry, it's sad, but that's what it is. You think I didn't hear him ask Adrian the same question twice?
One question, come on.
It's not just that. It's been getting worse for months. Everybody in town has seen it.
I looked at Trina. Everybody? Trina turned her eyes down to her feet and said nothing.
Violet already talked to the county board.
Ellen went on like a steamroller.
They've been in touch with the governor. He contacted the FBI and made a formal request for their child abduction team to take over the investigation. They'll be here in a few hours. It's done, Shelby. Tom is out.
Hours later, at 2 a.m, I broke from the tangles of the national forest land onto the dirt road. I'd gone back there to join the search, but my flashlight battery was dead. I was exhausted, and the sweat on my body had turned cold. My skin was bleeding where the branches had scratched me. I bent at the waist and put my hands on my knees as I got my strength back. Gnats swarmed around my warm breath. The noise of the crickets in the brush was deafening. When I stood up again, I stared out into the nighttime woods. Dozens of other dancing lights dotted the forest like fireflies. Every few seconds, someone called Jeremiah's name in the distance. Shoulder to shoulder, the people of Middle County hunted for the boy through the dark hours. My father stood alone by his cruiser. His car was parked near Jeremiah's bicycle, which lay where it had been abandoned and was now cordoned off by police tape. Dad still had his thermos of coffee in his hand, which he'd refilled at least 3 times over the course of the night. He'd had that dented flask as long as I could remember. It was the same one he'd been using on his boat the night he was visited by the owl. The night he'd found me. I walked over to him. He didn't even notice me at first because he was so caught up in his thoughts, as if thinking hard would bring Jeremiah back. He held himself with the stiff, proud bearing of a tin soldier. I remember thinking as a kid that bullets would just bounce off him. Jeremiah's not out there, Dad. He drank his coffee. He was still focused on the forest.
I know.
If he'd wandered off by himself, we would have found him by now. He couldn't have gone that far.
You're right.
We should call off the search until daylight, I said. Someone's going to get hurt out there. My father noticed the blood on my face.
What about you? Are you okay?
I'm fine. But we're not going to find him like this.
No, we're not.
The lights of the searchers reflected in his eyes and made his face look pale. A mosquito landed on his forehead and began feasting on his blood, but Dad didn't even bother brushing it away. What do you want me to do? I asked.
Go home, Shelby. Get a couple hours of sleep.
You should too.
No, I'll bring the people in. Then I'll go back to the office.
I'll go with you. He shook his head.
Tomorrow's going to be a busy day. You need to be ready for it.
I was too tired to argue with him. Okay. Good night, Dad. I began walking past the lineup of vehicles parked together like train cars on both sides of the dirt road. My own cruiser was near the far end.
Shelby?
He called after me. I stopped and turned around. Yes?
I'll find that boy.
I tried to summon a smile, because as of the next morning, I knew he wasn't going to be the one in charge of finding him. I know you will, Dad. Then he went on as if a brand new thought had sprung into his head.
Listen, it may be nothing, but Mrs. Norris was complaining about a peeping Tom outside her bedroom window last night. She thought it was someone staying at the motel. You should probably check it out.
I stared at him. He was dead serious. Sure, I replied, my voice cracking. Sure I will. I made it all the way down the road to my cruiser before I began to cry. Chapter 11. I squinted through the windshield into the darkness as I drove home. Around here, you have to be alert for night creatures. I had to brake hard near the ranger station to avoid a raccoon that rose up and gave my headlights a cold, disinterested stare with its masked eyes. The animal hunched its craggy shoulders at me and then slouched into the woods. He was lucky. Over the years, like most of the people here, I'd left behind my share of roadkill. Your first deer is a rite of passage for the young drivers of Middle County. The glow of stained glass windows welcomed me home. From the outside, our house still looked like a church. The steeple still pointed at the sky, although Dad had long ago replaced the cross with a weather vane. He kept the wooden siding painted church white, and he always left the downstairs lights on overnight to illuminate the windows for passersby. The multicolored panels told the story of Jonah and the whale. When I was 4 years old, I used to hide under my blankets with a flashlight and pretend that I was inside the belly of the beast. It felt surprisingly safe there. I climbed the stairs to the second floor. My room was at the back, with a sharply slanted ceiling, hardwood floor, and a row of windows overlooking the cemetery. My walls were filled with pictures of me and my father. My first day on the job, with him next to me, beaming with pride. Me in a dress for an eighth-grade school dance. Dad's 20th anniversary party as sheriff. Things like that. I had volleyball trophies on my dresser, as well as yellowed copies of the newspaper from our state championship and one of the balls we'd used in the winning game. 10 stuffed owls of different sizes were lined up on my window ledges. In one corner of the room beside the bed was a rocking chair, along with my guitar. I took a shower and washed off the day. I opened one of the windows, which made me shiver because I was still damp. I spent a long time staring at the woods. I was naked, but I didn't worry much about modesty because no one was around to see me, and the animals didn't care what I looked like. Eventually, I crawled under the blankets, and I wasn't even aware of falling asleep. I blinked, and the darkness was gone, and early morning light streamed into the bedroom. It was 5:30. Someone was ringing the bell at our front door. I put on a robe and ran downstairs. When I threw open the door, I found Keith Whalen standing there. He was still dressed as he had been in the cemetery the previous day. His beard line was heavy on his face. He didn't look as if he'd slept. Keith.
Sorry to bother you so early.
What are you doing here?
Well, actually, I never went home last night. Somehow I couldn't bring myself to leave the cemetery, so I slept in my car. I was heading out this morning, but I saw your cruiser and figured you were here.
Not for long. I have to get ready to go. I hoped he would get the message. I didn't want him here. But he lingered on the doorstep anyway. He flipped his hair back, his usual nervous gesture.
Hey, would you mind if I used your bathroom?
Okay, go ahead. I opened the door wider and let him inside. It was pretty impressive coming into our house because Dad had left the great space of the church wide open when he converted the place. Voices echo, and you still feel as if you should talk in a hushed tone. Keith had never been here before, and he drank in the arched windows and the high ceiling with its crossbeams.
Wow. Beautiful.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
You fit here, Shelby.
I had nothing to say to that. The bathroom's over there.
Thanks.
He went to do what he had to do, and I waited next to the front door. That was rude, but I wasn't offering an invitation to stay. He came back a couple of minutes later, admiring some of the church paintings that Dad had saved. When he looked at me, I saw him take note of the outline of my body, and I was uncomfortably aware of the fact that I wasn't wearing anything under the robe. He looked away quickly, but I knew we were both having the same memories, no matter how much I tried to crowd them out of my mind.
Thanks,
he said again. Sure.
Did you find whoever was lurking in the cemetery yesterday?
I knew he was stalling because he didn't want to go. It was Anna, I said.
Anna Helvig?